The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Good morning. I had planned to begin this morning by inviting everyone to join me in a few silent moments to refresh the mind of meditation. However, it was so silent and still out here, I decided that I would just start right in with the talk. Thank you all for coming today, and especially I'd like to extend a warm welcome to the new people coming here today for the first time. I've seen a few new faces, so thank you all very much for joining us. We've just finished a 40-minute period of meditation, and during this past week, the monastic community and lay residents had the opportunity for a 3-day silent meditation retreat. So I thought some reflections on meditation I would offer. That's what I would offer this morning, some reflections on meditation. Also, it seemed timely because this month we've honored Great Master Bodhidharma, who is well known for his meditation, for bringing the practice of meditation from India to China. And then last week, we remembered Reverend Master Jiyu, our own master for many of us, who started this temple back in 1970 and introduced me, among others, to this practice of meditation. So this idea has been with me all month of October. Furthermore, as you can see outside, everything's turning yellow and rust-colored and brown, and it's a time of turning within, so that's also fitting. The first reflection on meditation that I have has to do with gratitude. The gratitude for the Buddhas and ancestors from beginningless time who have passed on this practice to us so that we can do it today. I find myself falling into taking it for granted. Oh, there's the daily meditation practice. Oh, I've got to go to the hall again this morning. I can't lie in my bed like I might want to. I'll go to the hall. You know, it can be. I mean, this is allowed to pass on as quickly as possible. But, you know, it's. I find that I can take it for granted. I can forget about what this practice means to me. And what it means to me is it saved my life, and that's not melodramatic. I mean, this practice is magnificent for me, and that's the only way I can think to put it. Not taking it for granted. Nowadays, meditation is everywhere. All you need to do is Google the word meditation. I haven't tried it, but I'm sure there'll be numerous responses. Every possible tradition of Buddhism and other religions offering meditation of all stripes and flavors, yogic meditation, secular meditation for health and well-being and even for greater productivity at one's place of employment. So meditation is just everywhere, all kinds of meditation and easy to find. It wasn't always so. When I first became interested in meditation, I was 18 or 19 years old, and it was back in the mid-1960s. I stumbled across a book on someone's shelves called Concentration and Meditation, written by a British gentleman who was a practicing Buddhist. So I picked up the book, and I thought, this sounds interesting, because I was interested in exploring alternatives to the culture I had been offered, or the ways of being that I've been offered. So I picked this up, and the first section was on concentration, and the second section was on meditation, and it began with a dire warning: do not do this unless you have the guidance of a fully qualified teacher, or you could be in for some big trouble. At least that's how I interpreted it. I haven't seen the book for 55 years or something, so I don't know what it really says, but That's what I took from it. So I put the book right back on the shelf, and I said, okay, well. Then a couple of years later, meditation came into prominence when the members of a famous rock band went to India to study with a meditation teacher. All of a sudden, everybody was around me talking about meditation and going down to the local meditation center to pick up this practice. And I thought, oh boy, now I can get into it. Well, unfortunately, there was a fee, and I didn't at that time have the fee. So then again, I was disappointed, and I kind of forgot about it. Then many years went by, a decade or more, and I decided, you know, this life is really tough. I need a way to live this life in a better way than I'm doing right now. I need to take up that meditation. I need to find some way. And so I lived in a large city where there was a Zen place to go to, and I went to the Zen place. And, you know, I was a little bit scared by that, too. It seemed that all the practitioners were males of the height of 6 feet and above. And I didn't feel quite like I could settle in and be comfortable. And then I received a flyer in the mail about a series of classes being given at UC Extension. I'm a UC graduate, and so I would receive these flyers regularly. And this series was going to be called Soto Zen and the Mystical Experience, and it was going to be given by Reverend Master G.U. Kennett. So I thought, oh, I heard them talking about Kennett Roshi at the other Zen place. I think I'll check that out. And I went. And there is a saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And Reverend Master Jiu appeared. As Reverend Master Mayon was describing last week in her talk, Reverend Master Jiu was meditation, the embodiment of meditation. All she had to do to teach meditation was come into the room. I mean, for me, anyway, for me, her presence was so still and so solid that I recognized that this was a person from whom I could learn something. Even though I was still a little timid, mind you, but I recognized that I would be willing to take up meditation under this teacher's guidance, and so I did. But it took a while. And since that time, as I mentioned, meditation has just, opportunities for it have proliferated. But at that time, it wasn't so easy to find it. So when I start to take it for granted, I think about, you know, back when I was 18, 19, and I couldn't find a way to learn meditation. The next reflection is on meditation as a practice of awakening. Our serene reflection meditation tradition, or Soto Zen as it's called also, belongs to the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism. And in the Mahayana tradition, we aspire to bodhisattva, to be bodhisattvas, which can be translated as awakening beings. This is our aspiration. And for me, the practice of meditation is an essential nourishment for this aspiration. I can want to do good, and I can want to practice charity, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy, giving, vigor, and so on. Without meditation, I find that very difficult. If it just comes from my head here or from my emotions, that doesn't really sustain it. This practice of meditation is what sustains that aspiration for me. So awakening is emerging from sleep. Part of the dictionary definition says, awakening is becoming alive to something and on the alert. I take alert to mean heedful, as in the Buddha's teachings, the word heedful is sometimes used to represent awareness and consciousness and acting in a way that one wishes to act in accordance with one's aspirations, being heedful of thought, speech, and deed. So becoming alive to something and on the alert. It reminds me of when the light awakens me in the morning. This is how meditation awakens me from a lifetime of sleep and dreams driven by greed, anger, and delusion. The meditation is the awakening. There's a saying that I really appreciate, which is, the light of Buddha is increasing in brilliance, and the wheel of the Dharma is always turning. The light of Buddha increasing in brilliance. I had a sort of thought of all over the world somewhere the sun is rising. The light is touching some place right at this moment. Maybe that's not how it works, but this is how it seemed to me in my imagination, that at every moment the sun is coming up on the horizon and lighting the land and rousing the living beings from sleep. I love to wake up that way, by the light. Sometimes it's the alarm clock, though. That'll do. So the light of Buddha is increasing in brilliance, and as we're awakening, the light is increasing in brilliance. And the wheel of the Dharma is always turning. The wheel of the Dharma is our meditation practice. We are keeping the wheel of the Dharma turning, and we are keeping the light of Buddha increasing in brilliance through our practice of meditation. Sometimes it doesn't seem like we're doing much, and I like to remind myself that what we are doing is increasing the light of Buddha, turning the wheel of the Dharma. That's why when I give meditation instruction, I like to tell people that if you want to start a practice of meditation for yourself, I would recommend starting with a small amount of time each day, but concentrate more on each day rather than a long amount of time. The light of Buddha increases in brilliance, and as you develop the practice, it becomes less difficult to sit for a longer period of time. Sometimes awakenings are dramatic, such as the story of Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening when he sat under the Bodhi tree for 7 days. And as the morning star arose, he understood the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path to the cessation of suffering. And the way various texts relate this is that he awakened. He said, O house builder, thou art seen, thou shalt build no house no more. Achieved is the end of craving, my heart is at one with the unmade. The unmade, unborn, undying, unconditioned, that which is greater than ability of words to express. So that was a very dramatic awakening, and it still lights our path today. Reverend Master Jiyu used to also describe a gradual awakening, and she described it as a dimmer switch, gradually, if any of you have that in your house, gradually turning up, and the light just slowly increasing in brilliance as a person meditates and trains themselves in the precepts and in doing good. This is more in accordance with my personal experience than the great moment of awakening experienced by Shakyamuni Buddha. There are those moments of awakening. They occur, maybe not quite so dramatically, certainly not for me. However, there are what Reverend Master Jiyu used to quote D.T. Suzuki as calling the little moments that make one dance. the little awakenings, the eyes opening and seeing things as they really are, just for a little moment. I had, you know, there was such a little moment the other day during the meditation retreat when I was doing walking meditation, and I was just about to walk around behind the altar, and suddenly I just sensed that my eyes opened up, and I realized, here I am. Where have I been? And there was a sort of way of being present that appeared to me that, you know, I've been asleep for ages. And, you know, this wasn't, you know, I'm not comparing that with the awakening of Shakyamuni Buddha, but these little moments are what help us and keep our meditation going. And our meditation keeps them going. It's the wheel of the Dharma is always turning. One moment I was thinking after the retreat about what a terrible job I do in my monastic office. This is a habitual way I have of thinking about myself. It goes way back that no matter what I'm doing, I have this habitual way of telling myself that I'm doing a terrible job of it. I then remind myself of my favorite bumper sticker, "Don't believe everything you think." But some of these are pretty well ground in, these habitual conditionings, and meditation practice for me is what helps dissolve this. And so, you know, I immediately began to think in that same old way, and then, for no reason in particular, I thought, wait a minute, I'm not doing such a bad job after all. And that was it. I could forget all about it and go on with my day. So it does. It changes. The light of Buddha is increasing in brilliance. So I'm going to just mention a few lines from the Rules for Meditation of Great Master Dogen. During the meditation retreat that we just finished, every day we had evening service and we recited the Rules for Meditation. The Rules for Meditation starts out with some questions that Great Master Dogen was asking about his practice. He'd already been practicing for a long time. And he was asking, why are training and enlightenment differentiated? Why study the means of attaining it, since the supreme teaching is free? And then the scripture goes on to explain the answer that he discovered to his questions. The scripture says, the means of training are thousandfold, but pure meditation must be done. We train ourselves, we are able to train ourselves in many ways throughout the day with everything we do, in our work, in brushing our teeth, in walking from one place to another, in dealing with people. But pure meditation must be done. For me, pure meditation means sitting on the cushion in the meditation hall or in my room in the place of meditation. It doesn't mean that these other ways of training are any less than pure meditation. The way I see it for myself in my own experience is that sitting on my seat in the meditation hall, which is a nice empty room full of really nothing to distract me, I'm so easily distractible, that sitting in the meditation hall, there it is. You're sitting on a piece of platform that's so wide by so long, and that's the world for you there, and you're looking at the wall. That really helps me because of being easily distracted by all the myriad objects around. To me, I see that as a charging station for an electric car or an electronic device like a phone or something like that. You plug it into the wall. It doesn't stop it from functioning. You can still, well, the electric car, I wouldn't want to drive it while it's plugged in, but the little phones and things you can still use while they're plugged in. But to me, the function isn't separate from the recharging. The recharging is an essential part of the function, so they're not standing apart. The means of training are thousandfold, but pure meditation must be done. And Great Master Keizan says, when seated in pure meditation, What is intellectually known spontaneously vanishes, and self-consciousness is discarded. Your whole being's eye of wise discernment clearly sees Buddha nature and is from the first not deluded. So this is, for me, one of the very important meanings of meditation practice. Awakening means becoming alive to something, and for me, it's becoming alive to Buddha nature, the eye of wise discernment, which is from the first not deluded, is gradually opening. So, the scripture says, the rules for meditation, although the Buddha had great wisdom at birth, he sat in training for 6 years. Although Bodhidharma transmitted the Buddha mind, we still hear the echoes of his 9 years facing a wall. Some words of Shakyamuni, the Buddha, in the Dhammapada say, the active mind is difficult to tame, flighty and wandering wherever it wills. Taming it is essential, leading to the joy of well-being. So again, another way of expressing why study the means of cleansing it, since the supreme teaching is free. It's essential, leading to the joy of well-being. Bodhidharma's discourse on pure meditation says, since pure meditation embraces all methods and practices, I call it the essential one. He also says, awakening is but an instant away. And I think we recited or chanted some of that a couple of weeks ago in our Bodhidharma ceremony. So going on with the rules for meditation, you should meditate in a quiet room, eat and drink moderately, cut all ties, give up everything, think of neither good nor evil, consider neither right nor wrong. When I was writing out this talk, I realized that's all one sentence. I was kind of surprised. That crams a lot into one sentence. Starts out saying, you should meditate in a quiet room, eat and drink moderately. Okay, that makes good common sense. And then suddenly cut all ties, give up everything. Gets right in there to the deep end. So, cut all ties, give up everything. As I reflected on that phrase, what that means is when sitting in pure seated meditation, there are so many thoughts, opinions, emotions, and so on that arise. During this past retreat, I had trouble with trying to write this talk during the meditation periods, and I kept having to allow that to pass on, allow it to pass on. Well, I was afraid if I didn't work on writing the talk, you know, silently to myself during the meditation period, it wouldn't get done. No, let it pass on. Let it pass on. Not grasping it, not pushing it away, not judging. Let it pass on. It arises, abides, and passes on. To me, at this point in my training, cut all ties, give up everything means sitting in meditation, allowing what some texts called the 10,000 things or the myriad stuff that comes up in the mind, allowing it to arise, abide, and pass on. Some of this stuff has a pretty strong hold. And for this reason, one can't cut all ties, give up everything by simply using only the judgmental mind and or the emotional heart, which we have sort of in the West. We say this is the intellect mind up here. This is the emotion heart here. We can't use either of those to cut all ties, give up everything. We can use what we call the heart mind of meditation to cut all ties, give up everything, by simply allowing what comes up in our sitting practice to arise, abide, and pass. Right now, for me, those are the ties, and those are what I'm cutting, and that's what I'm giving up. Let's see here. it doesn't help me to say, okay, now you have to give this stuff up. You have to get rid of it or you're a bad trainee. You don't get rid of it. Nor do you say, well, I don't know. I'll wait until I feel more like letting this pass on. I'm really into it right now, so I'll wait until I feel more like letting loose of it. Well, maybe not. Maybe just trust and let it move on right this moment. Sometimes during this past retreat that we had, I had to ask for help because my mind was so busy during meditation periods that I just could. I was getting frustrated. This stuff, it was like having a mosquito buzzing around your ear at night in bed when you're trying to get to sleep. You know, you don't want to kill the mosquito, and at the same time, you really don't want it buzzing around your head. So I just had to ask for help. I had to say, I'm willing to do this practice. I know how essential this practice is. I know how important it is. I'm willing to do it. Please help me. I'm not sure to whom I was addressing this request for help. To the great universe, I might say. And it helps. It's not something separate from me. It's not me, myself. It's something that helps in need. And we contribute our part by being willing. That's really important. Reverend Master Jiyu taught me that, to be willing, how important it is. So think of neither good nor evil, consider neither right nor wrong. Those four lines actually, I guess, are the most important to me. Think of neither good nor evil, consider neither right nor wrong. As I go about my daily life, I ask myself, how many times today or this hour have I classified something as being either right or wrong, or either good or bad? Oh, it's shocking. Quite a few times. Judging is a form of grasping. It's a form of saying, you know, I know. I know everything. I'm all-knowing. I'm God. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. And I'm going to impose that on my circumstances and the people around me. Well, that doesn't work for me, I've found out. And I really like the way Reverend Master Daizui McPhillamy in his book, Buddhism from Within, talks about the sweet wine of being right. He says, there is not much in this world that is sweeter and more addictive than the wine of being right. And I know what he's talking about. Think of neither good nor evil. What about when terrible things happen? Well, I'm thankful to Reverend Master Mayon for last week talking about that, and in a way that was very helpful to me. And I would recommend listening to her talk of last week, The Dharma as Peace of Heart, which addresses that subject. I don't really want to go back over it now. I had planned to talk about that, but I'm going on long enough, and I recommend that talk of last week. What you can do is ask yourself, does it help this situation by my making judgments about it? And when I ask myself that question, it never seems to come up, yes, it's helping this situation, that I'm that I'm saying, look what those people are doing, they're so bad, you know, or something like that. It never has helped the situation in my experience. So, okay. On that note, asking questions for me is really a good way of dealing with things that come up in meditation, and especially the tendency to be judgmental is one thing that it helps with. And I would refer to Reverend Master Daishin Morgan's book, Buddha Recognizes Buddha, in terms of, he has a chapter on asking the question, what is this? And he's clear to say that this is not an adjunct to our practice. This is simply a way of bringing one's mind back to meditation, which is our practice. Each time the mind is wandering, bringing it back. And sometimes asking, what is this, can be a very helpful way just to bring the mind back to meditation. I find in my experience, for others it might be different. And I find that it's especially helpful if I don't expect an answer. What is this? And then just let it go and get on with sitting or get on with meditation in working meditation practice or whatever I'm doing. Reverend Master Jiyu used to teach us always to ask the Lord of the house before doing anything whatsoever. And I had what I might call now somewhat of a Sunday school understanding of that. Because I'd ask, and then I'd be expecting an answer. And I'd be expecting it right away, and I'd be expecting to hear it in kind of a booming voice with a lot of certainty that would say, "Margaret, go to the right." This never happened. And so finally I had to let go of that. I realized that Reverend Master Jiyu was talking about something at a level that I wasn't quite ready to understand. My understanding of it now is asking, what is this? And then just being willing to let it go, willing to go on in faith and confidence that by keeping up my meditation, following the precepts, doing what's good to do, that answer comes naturally of itself. Finally, in the scripture, Rules for Meditation, it says, "This type of meditation is not something that is done in stages. It is simply the lawful gateway to carefree peace." And I, reflecting on that phrase, I could see in my mind's eye a big iron gate, one of these fancy iron gates that might go around an estate or something like that, opening up into a big open space, which brought me to back to the Sir Edwin Arnold poem, The Light of Asia, which described something that came up for Shakyamuni Buddha during his long night of meditation before seeing the morning star and realizing the truth. After a whole lot of other stuff, a lot of which was quite unpleasant, in the third watch of the night, it was insight vast, ranging beyond this sphere to spheres unnamed, system on system, countless worlds and suns moving in splendid measures, band by band, linked in division, one yet separate. The silver islands of a sapphire sea, shoreless, unfathomed, undiminished, stirred with waves which roll in restless tides of change. That's the reflection that came up for me on the line, simply the lawful gateway to carefree peace. Now, that was Shakyamuni Buddha's experience as described by one poet. I don't have that vast an insight personally, but this is what it suggests. The lawful gateway to carefree peace is our practice. And at the end of the scripture, it says, "If you do these things for some time, you will become, as herein described, and then the treasure house will open naturally, and you will enjoy it fully." So I hope something I have said will help you all to continue your meditation practice, and thank you again.